humming machinery and linked to chattering cogitators by snaking lengths of heavily insulated cables. That such a thing could exist at all flew in the face of all he had learned in the Apothecarian. Its head slumped to the side, and its pale flesh, stinking and greasy, was pasted over the sunken bones of its skull like wet parchment. The lower half of its face was a grotesquerie of moving parts, augmeters, vox implants, and sound-creating anatomies that chattered with strange clicks, whistles, and ticks. Its skull had been taken apart and remade, a mix of brass, bone, and glass, like a vat for the preservation of a hideous medical anomaly. The fluid within was cloudy and stagnant, and the visible portions of its hybridized brain pressed against the glass, the bleached white of something long dead. Nor was it wholly human. Portions of its mandibular structure were clearly Xenos in origin, though sourced from no alien Tarsa had ever fought. It wore a blindfold, for no one could look into its pain-filled eyes and not be horrified at its suffering. Garuda shuffled from clawed foot to clawed foot atop the throne. Tarsa thought it looked like some scavenger bird, waiting for a hanged man to die so it could peck his eyes out. A wet, organic sounding binaric issued from its throat. Yellowish fluid dribbled from its jaws as it formed the unwords over and over again. A lectern bolted to the deck before it flickered with light, burbling a stream of nonsensical data in an endless loop.
"What is this abomination saying?"
asked Ulrich Branthon, leaning down so that his mutilated features were an inch from those of the Kryptos. The irony of Branthon calling the Kryptos an abomination was not lost on Tarsa.
"The cogitators are trying to figure it out," said Wayland,
feeding brass-edged punch cards into the logic engine.
"This is a dead vox band. No one's used these channels for centuries. Whoever is transmitting must be desperate indeed to hope their message will be picked up by anyone with the capabilities to translate it. The Selenar were said to use an organic form of genobinary, a lingua technis utilizing a rotating cipher based upon the sender's unique genome sequence, which made it almost impossible to decode."
"So we can't know what it's saying," said Branthon.
I didn't say that,
said Thematica, wagging an admonishing finger.
"Can you break the code and spare me a Historia lecture, yes or no? I rather suspect the Selenar did not envisage the existence of the Kryptos when they developed this form of communication," said Thematica, "which surprises me, as some of the bioengineered chimeras they wrought in their vaults were not entirely dissimilar, and..."
"I said yes or no, Freighter."
"Yes,"
said Wayland, as the cogitator spat out glowing lines of text.
"You have it,"
said Thematica.
"I have it,"
said Wayland.
"You were right. I had to run the genome sample back multiple iterations until the Kryptos was able to break it."
"What does it say?"
said Tarsa, before the two Iron Fathers could go deep into the technicalities of their cryptography. Wayland nodded and said,
"It says, these are the words of Talab Vita 37. My iteration is my name. My sequence speaks to the veracity of my words. The wolves are loosed and Luna falls again. My truth is this. I have failed. For centuries I kept the Magna Martyrs safe, but the first son of Horus calls Ebathan to his master. Any who hear this, I beg you to destroy Lunar Dome Herodotus Omega. Wipe it clean of life before he breaks the seventh seal."
A shiver ran down Tarsa's spine.
"The Magna Mater," he said.
"Do those words mean something to you, Apothecary?"
asked Branthon.
"Yes. It means we must reach Luna with all haste," said Tarsa.
Before Branthon could ask anything else, the Kryptos shrieked in paroxysms of agony. Its back arched, and it thrashed in the throes of a violent seizure as the shrieks of something infernal tore through its open mind.
"Carnage! Carnage! Carnage!"
"Get us out of here!"
barked Tyro, getting behind the command lectern. Sharukin tried to make sense of what he was seeing on the Auspex station. The display screamed with the lunatic ravings of the incoming vessel. Its ululating howl was a mindless exultation, insane agony given voice.
"We're still anchored to the graving dock," said Sharakin.
"Then cast us off!"
"Working on it."
The Sisyphium shuddered as enemy munitions detonated on its rear quarter.
"Work faster,"
ordered Tyro. A deep bass rumble echoed through the Sisyphium superstructure. The booming clangs of docking clamps disengaging sent shuddering vibrations through the deck plates.
"Releasing," said Sharakin. "Now find that ship."
The deck tilted underfoot as Tyro pushed power to the drives. Local gravity skewed strangely as the Sisyphium powered away from the mass of the coaling station. More juddering tremors raced the length of the ship, its steel skeleton deforming under the torsion and shearing forces of battle. A powerful explosion rocked the ship. Gravity weakened, then strengthened. Recently repaired systems blew out again. The servitors chattered to one another in squeals of simplified binaric.
"Where is it, Sharokin?"
"Below us, I think. Show me."
Sharokin threw the display onto the viewscreen. Cascades of crackling photons fell in a waterfall of light. Patterns of distortion swam in the illumination, peaks and troughs representing energy signatures, radiation spikes, and patches of heat. Sharokin could make little of what he was seeing, but Tyro was a master of void war, and immediately saw opportunity in the riot of atomic flares and laser discharges.
"He's damaged and too eager," said Tyro. "His Auspex couldn't clearly distinguish us from the coaling station, so he fired too soon."
The vox horns blared,
"Carnager, Carnager, Carnager." "He's pushing in on our ventral axis," said Tyro, "trying to disembowel us. And you know how to prevent that. I fought us clear of Istvan V, didn't I?"
"Then this should be easy."
More hits struck the ship's underside, raking fire designed to strip a vessel's shields. The Sisyphium's voids had yet to ignite, and every hit was a penetrating wound. Fire bloomed alongside jets of freezing oxygen. Their ship was bleeding into the vacuum of space.
"Please tell me Thematica chose to rearm the prow cannon," said Tyro.
"I don't know, Captain."
"Get me a firing solution anyway."
"A firing solution? How? Weapons control is smashed."
"Then give it your best guess."
"Hold on."
Sharokin stumbled over to weapons control as Tyro cut the Sisyphium's drive and fired every one of its maneuvering thrusters against their direction of travel. The ship groaned in protest at so drastic a deceleration, compressional forces stressing the keel from stern to bow. Sharokin slammed into the console. Freshly welded armor plates tore loose and hydraulic lines blew out all along the strike cruiser's length. Deafening squalls of interference echoed through the vaults of the bridge as close-in deflectors ruptured and the carnage's course angled it upwards in front of the Sisyphium. Proximity alarms blared as the two city-sized ships practically grazed one another.
"We're going to collide," said Sharokin.
He had witnessed two capital ships crashing once before in low orbit over Kiovar. Until the massacre at Istvan V, it had been one of the worst things he'd ever seen. Ancient works of the shipwright's art, torn apart by unimaginable forces. 10,000 dead in the first instant, flash frozen by the hard vacuum of space as their hulls ripped open. 100,000 more burned in oxygen-rich fires, sprinting through the wreckage and vaporizing everything in their path. The Auspex swelled with emag bloom. The Carnager was everything. It blotted out all else with its murder bulk.
"Carnager! Carnager! Carnager!"
The signature was so vast it filled the Auspex. Sharokin switched back to the ordinary view through the oculus bay. The jagged, blood-daubed hull of the Carnager filled the viewscreen.
"Fire!"
yelled Tyro. Sharokin sent the order, hoping against hope that Newman's argument had won out. The bombardment cannon shell travelled the distance to its target in a fraction of a second, and its armour-piercing cone bored through the plating of its command deck half a second later. The Carnager spasmed with the force of the blast, the cone of the explosion's plasma jet cutting down like a power sword through the spine of an outflanked foe. The traitor vessel's keel was sliced clean through, and the two halves of the ship buckled inward as though folding at a hinge point. Plumes of fire filled the screen, a blazing inferno devouring every scrap of oxygen within the Carnager. Its hull bulged and blew out as secondary explosions ripped along its length in a cascade of obliteration. The Sisyphean powered through the explosion, the light of the Carnage's destruction filling the bridge with the hellish fire of a void death. Warning lights and damage icons lit up across every station, but it didn't matter. The Carnager was dead.
"Good kill," said Tyro.
Book 2. Mother. She has become everything and everyone. To recognize this is to live in wonder. Chapter 4. Ibathan. Magna Mater. The Ocean of Storms. The descent through the solar disk took another 7 days. Branthan demanded greater speed, but the Sisyphean was slowly dying. Critical systems were failing faster than the Iron Hands could repair them, and if Branthan pushed too hard, he would strand them in the endless dark. Snapshots of the war came to them through intermittent Vox signals. Impossible reports of exploding moons, of Rogal Dawn's flagship besieged, and fleet engagements beyond anything anyone had seen in living memory. So many lurid tales of the void afire and planets shattered that they blurred together in an unending stream of horror, death, and atrocity. The War Master had come in overwhelming force, leaving nothing to chance and wrong-footing the defenders of Terror at every turn. The solar system was burning. After Tyro and Sharokin's destruction of the Carnager, an uneasy comity had been restored to the Sisyphean, in part due to the revelations brought to them by Atesh Tarsa via the Kryptos, but also Branthan's acceptance that Tyro was his equal. The silver disk of Luna filled the viewscreen, the first light of old Earth's night. Wayland brought them in slowly, as far as possible from the vast traitor fleets anchored in high orbit and awaiting their tasking orders for Terra. Despite every horror the warriors aboard the Sisyphean had faced and overcome, nothing could have prepared them for the sight of their former brothers massing over the throne world. World Eaters, Sons of Horus, Death Guard, Emperor's Children, Thousand Sons. Names that were once bywords for courage, honor, and nobility. Now they could no longer be said without suffering a blade of grief to the heart.
"So many," said Thematica.
"How can Terra possibly hold?"
"Lord Dawn has had years to prepare for this day," said Cadmus Tyro. "If anyone can hold Terra, it will be him. Hold to that, brothers."
Tyro's words were spoken confidently, and though the Praetorian of Terra's reputation was well deserved, everyone on the Sisyphean understood that even the greatest master of siege defense would blanch at facing this numberless host. The dark side was lousy with the burning wrecks of defense platforms, whose orbits were steadily declining as they shed plates of armor like bladed rain to the lunar surface. Wayland fought to keep the Sisyphean's plasma signatures low, relying on the maneuvering jets to fractionally alter course to avoid drifting city-sized chunks of debris hurled into orbit by the force of the traitor bombardments. In truth, there was virtually no need for stealth. The wounded emissions of their ship's reactor core blended with the atomic firestorms, painting the black curve of the horizon with a borealis of blood.
"The Salinar cults fought hard," said Tyro. "The traitors paid a heavy price."
"As did the Imperium at its dawn,"
pointed out Wayland. Explosions still flared over the glowing curve of the lunar surface, and blinking streams of laser light flashed between the last remaining defenders and the enemy's murder ships.
"Are we sure the fight is over?"
asked Newman.
"It's over," said Tarsa.
"How do you know, Salamander?"
said Branthan. Tarsa drew a finger across his neck.
"Ibathan," he said.
In the wake of the Carnage's destruction, they had gathered in the armory to debate the significance of the message received by the Kryptos. Surrounded by their meager supply of weapons and ammunition, Atesh Tarsa told them what he knew.
"You have heard the term Ibathan before?" asked Tyro.
Tarsa nodded.
"I have. My legion fought alongside the Lunar Wolves, back when they still held to that name. Back when we still counted them as brothers. During those years, I heard the word Ibathan more than any other."
"What does it mean?" said Sharokin. seated on an empty ammo crate.
It is a Chthonian term for the cutting of a Rafa gang leader's throat all the way back to the spine, explained Tarsa. The term was adopted by the Legion to mean the successful conclusion of a campaign.
Tyro shook his head.
So it signals the traitors have taken Luna. We already knew that. It changes nothing. We should still make for Terra. No, insisted Tarsa. We have to reach Luna.
Why?
Said Branthon.
Because of this Magna Mater? What is it?
Tarsa hesitated before speaking. Eventually he took a breath and said,
I am a proud son of Nocturne, born and raised in the shadow of Mount Deathfire. My first breath was ashes and smoke, my first sight a sky filled with flame, and my first grip was upon a smiting hammer. My word is my bond, and every oath I have sworn remains unbroken.
None gathered here doubt you, Brother Tarsa, said Wayland. Why do you tell us this?
Because just as every tech priest is inducted into the mysteries of the sacred machine on the Red Planet, so too are apothecaries made privy to secret knowledge birthed deep in Luna's vaults. To reveal the moon's secrets, even to my battle-sworn brothers, would be to break a gravely sworn oath.
Understood, apothecary, said Branthon. But if this is information your commander requires, you are duty-bound to reveal it. I give you leave to break your oath.
With respect, Captain Branthon, you are not of the 18th, and even if you were, that leave is not yours to give, said Tarsa. In this moment, I choose to break this oath. The burden of that will be mine to bear until my death.
Nykona Sharukin came forward and placed a hand on Tarsa's shoulder guard. I have known you since the betrayal at Istvan, said the Raven Guard. In that time we have shed our own blood and that of the traitors. You call a different world home and name another Primarch as your liege lord. But we are brothers, you and I. We are bonded in a way that few beyond our grim confraternity will ever know. All of us here understand what holding true to an oath means, what it really means. We would not be fighting our brothers if we did not. We fight against a foe that broke their sacred oaths. So I understand why you hesitate. But we are nearing the end of this war, and even a fractional misstep may cost us dearly. I know it is wrong of us to expect this of you, but if breaking your oath shares information that will help us fight the traitors, then it is a burden I willingly share.
As do I,
said Sabic Wayland.
And I,
said Thematica. Ignatius Newman said,
I'd sooner die than break an oath, but if you must, then I'll gladly share the burden of yours, if it means we stick a Numa wrench in the War Master's plans.
Thank you, brothers, said Tarsa.
So tell us,
said Branthon.
What is the Magna Mater?
Understand this first, Captain Branthon, said Tarsa. The Selenar's rites are shrouded in metaphor and symbolism. Even after years learning from them, it was difficult to be certain of anything, especially when the Legion warriors were viewed as little better than spies. My understanding of the Luna faith is incomplete, for the Selenar do not easily share the truth of a belief system that almost saw them destroyed in the earliest days of the First Solar War. I want you all to understand that before I go on.
We understand, said Tyro. Go on.
Tarsa nodded.
Broadly speaking, their cults believe each individual life is but the sum total of genetic archetypes that have endured throughout human history. Like most faiths, they are heavily factionalized, and each cult venerates the helical mysteries of our species in different ways.
Newman growled and shook his head.
We've wiped out cultures for less.
Indeed we have, said Tarsa,
more sharply than he intended.
But the Selenar had two things the Emperor needed. A knowledge of genecraft that outstripped his own, and industrial-scale facilities to match the scope of his ambition. Thus, they were spared obliteration. The Emperor yoked Luna's cults and tasked them with building armies mighty enough to conquer a galaxy.
And the Magna Mater? It was linked to this faith of theirs?
Asked Tyro.
I never heard any of the Gene Witches speak of the Magna Mater directly, but oblique references to it lie at the heart of every one of their most secret mysteries, said Tarsa,
struggling to find words to express a mystery even he did not fully understand.
Its literal meaning is Great Mother, an ancient Romani name for Sibylle.
The Anatolian goddess of fertility and creation, said Thematica.
Yes. During my time on Luna, it was little more than a myth, said to be the fabled fountainhead of the earliest and most powerful space marine genetics. I never believed it ever truly existed, more that it was likely an allegorical representation of their vast knowledge. But what if it does exist? What if it is something tangible? What if it is the very source code of the space marines? Imagine that power in the hands of the traitors. That is why we must set course to Luna and not Terra.
And this Talab Vita 37, her words carry weight?
Asked Ulrak Branthon. Tarsa nodded.
Given the numerous following her designation, Talab Vita 37 must be a senior member of the Selenar cults. So yes, her words carry weight.
Then do we do as she asks?
Said Newman.
Do we destroy the lunar dome?
Let us not be hasty, said Thematica. If the Magna Mater is literally the root of the most powerful space marine genetics, surely we cannot simply destroy it out of hand.
If a Gene Witch of Talab Vita 37's rank says it must be done, then she has good reason, said Tarsa. The Lunar Wolves must be close to taking it.
How will we even destroy a mountain? Asked Tyro. That's what she's ultimately asking for, is it not? A Lunar Dome is a dead volcano, yes?
It is, said Tarsa.
Then how do you imagine we could do that?
Said Newman.
The Sisypheum no longer has the capability to destroy much of anything, let alone an entire volcano.
You can destroy any location if you can get inside it, said Sharokin.
Wayland, your support here would be appreciated, said Thematica. You cannot seriously think this is the right course of action. No Iron Father would sanction the destruction of knowledge.
In that you are correct, said Wayland. But if the Magna Mater truly is what Apothecary Tarsa suspects it may be, then the threat of the traitors getting it off Luna is too great a risk. Regrettably, I believe we have no choice but to destroy the Lunar Dome.
In desperation, Thematica turned his focus to Cadmus Tyro and Ulrak Branthon.
Captains, this knowledge is what allowed the Emperor himself to build the Legiones Astartes. None of us would be here without it. It is our heritage, our genetic link to the past. To allow it to be consumed by fire will deny the hope for a future.
Thematica paused to collect his thoughts before speaking again, taking great effort to contain his mounting frustration and disbelief at what he was hearing.
Brothers, this war against Horus has taken a grievous toll on our ranks, and who knows how many of us will be left alive when finally the guns fall silent. The Emperor will need this knowledge if he is to rebuild the Imperium back from the ashes. It is our sacred duty to save it for the Space Marines yet to be, the warriors who will come after us and stand on the walls in the ages yet to come.
Cadmus Tyro folded his arms and said,
I agree with you, but the risks are too great. Captain Branthon, what are your thoughts?
The risks are great,
agreed Ulrak Branthon.
But nothing of worth was ever achieved without some risk. I will offer you this course of action, Freighter Thermatica. We will go to Luna, and we will make every attempt to secure the Magna Mater. But if there is even the slightest chance of it falling into the hands of the traitors, we destroy it. Agreed?
It was the best Thematica was going to get, and he knew it.
Agreed,
he said. The Sisypheum drifted through the debris field of Luna's Great Ring. The destroyed belt of defensive platforms had once formed an unbreakable circuit around the moon's circumference, a lethal cordon of lance batteries, torpedo launchers, and macro-cannon arrays. Wreckage from the devastated ring still tumbled in the upper reaches of lunar space, burning like comets in the void. Layered banks of debris wreathed the surface in shadow, as clouds of ablated fragments and pulverized metal fell in ever-declining orbits to the surface. To see something so monolithic brought low was almost beyond comprehension. Its defenses had been designed to repel a sustained campaign of invasion, but it had been obliterated in an instant. The darkness over Luna was a stark reminder that nothing was unbreakable. Even with the distortions and interference fouling the lunar atmosphere, the descent of a vessel of the Sisypheum's displacement would not go unnoticed. So Wayland had brought them close to the surface within a vast, hollowed-out cylinder of falling wreckage. In addition to enabling them to reach the surface undetected, it served the secondary purpose of shielding them from the falling debris. It had once been a facility for mass warhead launches on the ring's Corward defensive array, and its smouldering descent was currently arcing a solder-bright line over the Oceanus Procellarum. Its rate of tumble was low, and thus Wayland had moored the Sisypheum within its latticed structure in a feat of bravura piloting skills. Maglocks and sinew-taut tethers kept the ship in place, immobile and silent. In around 15 hours, the falling structure would slam down somewhere over the southern polar regions. The Sisypheum's mission would be over then. Sharokin peered over Wayland's shoulder through the patched and cracked canopy of the Storm Eagle as the endless grey expanse of Terra's moon drifted below. The battered gunship hung inverted from an open embarkation deck, ready to drop to the surface at Wayland's command. Even though they were shielded from the worst of the debris rain falling from orbit, a rattling clanging of impacts transferring through the gunship's hull sounded unnervingly like taking small arms fire. Lunar Dome Herodotus Omega was a solitary shield volcano to the south of a pair of impact craters in the midst of the Oceanus Procellarum. One, a high albedo crater known as Aristarchus, was empty and desolate, but the other was filled with the arc lights of a port facility. The rim of this crater was ringed with lifter arrays, hanging limp over fire-dusted platforms, surrounded by materiel hangars and transit hubs that wound out over the surface. Stationed 500 metres above the largest platform was the bladed form of a starship.
"Sons of Horus Destroyer," said Wayland,
reading the vessel's mass and displacement by its outline.
"Hunter class. Onboard registry lists it as the Chthonian Scion."
"Just a gunboat," said Sharokin.
"Still orders of magnitude too powerful for us," said Wayland. "We've enough rounds for maybe one dogfight. After that, we'll be shooting mass reactives from the hatches."
Wayland opened a vox channel to the troop compartment.
"There's an enemy vessel stationed on target," he said.
The vox crackled with a strange double echo as Brantham replied,
"Has it seen us?"
"No,"
said Wayland.
"We'd already be dead if it had." "Then we proceed as planned," ordered Branthon. "Understood, Captain," he said.
Sharokin had never thought to be this close to Luna, one of the great mythic locations of the solar system. Its rugged surface was strewn with blackened battle wreckage from the destroyed ring, and shards of metal hung in glittering veils like layered bands of sediment in a dark ocean. Despite all that, Luna was something of a disappointment.
"Not much to look at, is it?"
said Wayland, as if reading his thoughts.
"It's not what I expected," admitted Sharokin.
"What did you expect?"
"Something like a forge world, I suppose. Temples, towers, and domes, that sort of thing."
"Ah, then you should see Mars sometime," said Wayland fondly. "The seat of the Martian priesthood is studded with ancient structures. Its volcanoes crowned with glittering forge temples and titanic monuments to man's union with machinery. The planet's metal skin is threaded with thrumming power conduits, like veins through red flesh. And to watch the rise of the Mechanicum Borealis as it crowns Olympus Mons is to know beauty."
"That's certainly not Luna," said Sharokin, staring at the ocean of silver dust and ancient impact craters.
"No,"
agreed Wayland.
"Mars has always been brash in its displays of power, but the Selenar keep their secrets well hidden."
"The best way to keep a secret is to not let anyone know you have a secret in the first place," said Sharokin.
The ability to create life is the greatest power of all, said Wayland. It's hard to keep something like that secret.
It surprises me to hear an Iron Hand say that, said Sharokin.
Why? Because we know that flesh is ultimately weaker than iron? Or because you think we despise flesh?
I'm not sure. Both? Your creed is still a mystery to me.
You are not Medusan, and your genesire was not murdered before your very eyes. How could you possibly understand my legion?
Said Wayland.
I do not say that as any kind of insult, my friend. It is simply a fact. You would not expect me to understand the soul of your legion after so short a time, would you?
No.
The Tenth know that flesh is weak, but the mystery of its creation, that is miraculous. Not even the greatest minds of Mars could achieve that.
Don't let Thematica hear you say that, or he'll take it as a challenge. Wayland grinned and pointed farther south as the flat, oblate form of Herodotus Omega slid into view upon the inverted horizon. A waypoint alert chimed on the avionics panel. Wayland toggled the vox.
Drop in 10, he said then to Sharokin. You should get back to the troop compartment. This cockpit isn't really designed for a co-pilot.
This isn't going to be a high G launch, is it?
No, just a detachment and a glide.
Then I'll stay, said Sharokin, his gaze fixed on the unremarkable form of the volcano, wondering what secrets it held. Do you believe the Magna Mater is real? Wayland nodded to the looming shadow of the destroyer holding station over the landing platforms. A repulsor haze blurred the ground beneath it, and clashing vortices of gravitational force surrounded it in a spinning cloud of dust and razored fragments.
The sons of Horus believe it, he said. That is enough for me.
Sharokin nodded.
Detachment in 3, 2, 1, release.
There was no thunder of launch rails or shuddering scream of ramjets, no boom of disengaging docking clamps, just the distant tremor of tethers retracting into the Storm Eagle's hull. Gravity shifted a heartbeat to the left, and the gunship drifted into the lunar void, carried clear by a gentle whiff of manoeuvring jets and the rotation of the torpedo launch facility. Borne outwards and down by a combination of weak gravity and thrust, the Storm Eagle rotated on its long axis and tilted its nose upward. Sharokin's breath caught in his throat as sunlight flared on the canopy and an armored grey orb hove into view. Its surface was mottled brown and steel-dust grey, with volatile patches of sulphurous yellow drifting in the upper atmosphere. Swirls of storms were already developing over the northern hemisphere, and spots of light, traitor warfleets taking up bombardment positions, glittered like fireflies in high orbit. Terra, breathed Sharokin. The throne world. Humanity's birthrock and cardinal world of the Imperium. World of legend, where his species had first crawled from the ocean so many millions of years ago, where life had first looked up at the starry night, first with wonder, then intrepidity, before finally ambition.
Even at bay, it's beautiful, said Wayland.
I saw a painting by Serena D'Angelus once, said Sharokin. I mean, it was a picked render of it, but her colours were like nothing I had ever seen. I know little of beauty beyond the play of shadows in darkness, but even to my eyes it was beautiful. It was called Terra Gaia, and was said to be what the throne world looked like back when it was known as Earth. A blue-green orb, radiant with life and wonder.
Before the choking breath of its endless forges brought life to the edge of extinction,
finished Wayland.
Yes, I know the piece.
I wish I'd known Terra when it had colour like that, said Sharokin, as the contested planet slid out of view. It must have been wondrous. Chapter 5. Landing. The Sibylline Oracle. Moon-blooded. Herodotus Omega filled the horizon, its trench-like caldera frozen and its magma heart long since extinct. Many of the lunar volcanoes had been brought back to life by the core drills of Martian geoformers, but Herodotus Omega had, for unknown reasons, remained cold and dead. Little could be gleaned of what they might expect to find within the meagre records available. With the Chthonian scion so close, Wayland didn't dare risk an active surveyor sweep or attempt a penetration of whatever remained of the lunar noospheric network. The Sisyphium's cogitators listed Herodotus Omega only as an abandoned research site, but those records were over 2 centuries old and likely out of date, so were next to valueless. Passive surveyors detected scores of vessels charting leisurely circuits far overhead, and numerous, seemingly random, surveyor pulses. None of them were directed at the surface. The only threat that truly mattered was the Chthonian Scion. Wayland kept his attention split between the threat board and the view beyond the canopy. The traitor destroyer wasn't actively surveying the local area, but all it would take was one glitch of the Storm Eagle's damaged systems, or one lousy interaction with the endless drift of tumbling debris fouling an engine, to alert the machine spirits of the enemy Auspex. If that happened, this mission was over. Destruction would follow detection, as sure as day followed night. The Storm Eagle was now a glider, descending on a gently curving arc towards the looming form of Herodotus Omega. Wayland had kept the Sisyphium concealed in the launch facility's wreckage long enough that the Storm Eagle was likely below any local survey nets or the watchful eyes of any lunar Auspex sites that hadn't already been destroyed. Sharokin flinched as the avionics panel chimed with faint warnings. A rotating sine wave jumped on the brass-rimmed slate as low-grade emissions washed over the gunship. Burbling static hissed from the panel, followed by a squall of binaric pops and screeches.
"Don't worry," said Wayland, sensing his reaction. "They're just Auspex ghosts. Trapped echoes bouncing from the crater walls."
Sharokin craned his neck to scan the horizon, searching for any sign that another ship had them locked in its sights and was even now preparing to blast them from the sky. He saw nothing. But wasn't that always the way of it? The old-timers always said it was the strike you never saw coming that killed you. "Are you sure?" he asked.
"No, but given the density of the orbital traffic around Luna, it seems likely."
Sharokin now understood enough about Auspex craft to know Wayland was probably right, but the crackling hisses issuing from the panel felt like more than just echoes. There was something oddly predatory to them, like the malicious purring of a felid toying with its prey before delivering the crippling blow. But the sound faded, and the jumping sine wave on the slate returned to its safe rippling line. He let out a breath and said, "Where do you plan to set down?"
"At the end of the valley," said Wayland, pointing to the northeastern flank of Herodotus Omega, where the sharply defined shadow of a deep chasm approached the lower haunches of the volcano. "From the orbital pics I took, it looks like there's an unfinished geothermal venting station built into the dome's flank."
"Unfinished?"
"So it appears," said Wayland. "If I had to hazard a guess, I'd say the Mechanicum originally planned to reignite the volcano, but the work was never completed."
"Why not?"
"Who can say?" replied Wayland.
A Storm Eagle was a heavy assault gunship that could transport up to 20 space marines into the heart of a battle. Its armor was rugged and durable, and its weapons normally packed a punch far beyond its relatively small size. Tyro scanned the numerous empty seats around him with a deep sense of melancholy. He remembered this ship filled with warriors, the midnight black and burnished silver of their battleplate gleaming and bedecked with oaths of moment. How proud they had been. How noble. He remembered gut-churning drops through volatile atmospheres, thundering runs through enemy flak, steel, and fire, as hulls ripped open and seeing a sky filled with explosions. Given the wounds he had suffered at the hands of Alpharius on Irene Septimus, he ought to be confined to the Apothecarian. But this was a moment where every one of them had to dig deep into what made them sons of Ferus Manus. Wayland and Thematica had helped him don his armor, a time-consuming and painful process, but it felt good to be clad in iron once more. The warplate compensated for the worst of his wounds, but Tyro knew he was entering this fight with his body nigh broken. Appropriate, he thought. Some among the guerrilla forces fighting in the hidden spaces between the major engagements of the war against Horus had taken to calling themselves Warriors of the Shattered Legions. Tyro had not liked the term upon first hearing it, believing it diminished their capabilities and cohesion. That warriors of the Iron Tenth could ever be described as shattered sat poorly with him, But as time had gone on, he had come to see it for what it truly meant. You may break and burn us, but still we rise. Tyro's eyes slid over his fellow warriors, as ragged and ill-tempered a group of survivors as any commander had known. He rose from his armored grav seat and moved down the compartment, pausing beside Ignatius Newman to wrap the knuckles of his gauntlet upon the warrior's dented and offset shoulder guard.
I should upbraid you for the poor condition of your armor.
Newman looked up, uncertain, deaf to what Tyro had just said. Tyro moved on, lifting Tarsa's bolter from his hands and turning it over with a judgmental eye. The eagle-stamped magazine was chipped and dented, the trigger guard snapped off. He handed it back to the salamander and said,
I would assign you punishment duty for the unrepaired damage to your weapon.
Stopping in front of Thematica, Tyro examined the configuration of his grenades and ammunition.
And as for you, Ironfather, what battlefield role is your loadout designed for?
For whatever awaits us on the surface, said Thematica. We have little left with which to fight in any formally prescribed manner.
Tyro nodded and turned to face his Legion brothers, marking each of them in turn. As a captain, he had led the warriors of the Iron Tenth for over a century, fighting from the fringes of the solar system all the way to Istvan V. He had seen courage beyond anything the most fanciful retelling of a remembrancer could invent. Yet that paled in comparison to the courage of the men arrayed before him in this moment.
On any normal day, I would censure every one of you, he began. But this is not a normal day. Since Istvan V, we have known no normal days. Since that black day of betrayal, we have come far, risked much, and lost more. We have travelled into the realm of monsters to face our greatest foes, and we have hurt them. Like Taliantha of ancient Medusa, we lanced the belly of the great dragon and left a trail of its blood for others to follow, slowing it and weakening it in readiness for the deathblow. It has been a long, dark, and bloody road, brothers. We have seen comrades fall, one by one, but we have never faltered.
Tyro paused before continuing, seeing Ulrak Branthan at the far end of the troop compartment, watching him with pain-filled eyes.
This will be our last mission together, said Tyro. And no matter what happens, know that I am prouder than I have ever been to have known you and fought alongside you.
The assembled warriors nodded solemnly. They were grateful for the truth of his sentiment, but no one gave a rousing response or hammered a fist to the chest at his words. Too much blood had been spilled, and too many friends lost along the way for that. Tyro marched between them to take a seat close to Branthan. The grav seats were too small for the transformed captain's armored bulk. He simply stood, hunched over at the end of the compartment, like the statue of some grotesque god at the nave of a heathen fane. Garuda sat over his head in the stowage rack, its head folded under one wing, as though it were asleep.
Fine words, Captain Tyro, said Branthan, though they were laden with a sense of finality. Do you think we will fail?
These men have triumphed against impossible odds time and time again, said Tyro.
That's not an answer, said Branthan,
reading the undertow in Tyro's words.
I know, said Tyro. But win or die, this will be our last fight.
The lunar landscape rose to meet them, but Sharokin found it hard to gauge just how high they were. The rugged grey landscape was without defining characteristics to give it scale, and what few features there were offered no clue to their true size. They could have been 1,000 meters above the ground, or 100. The threat display continued to pop and whistle with a strange doggerel of electronic noise. The gentle bulge of Herodotus Omega filled the canopy, its distance likewise impossible to accurately measure by sight alone. Its flanks were smooth silver, its peak ridged with glittering lights that might be structures or marker beacons. Distortion from the Chthonian Scion's gravwash rippled the top of the extinct volcano, and billowing clouds of lunar dust haloed the summit like mountain mist.
"Bringing her down,"
said Wayland, easing the Storm Eagle into a curving turn to starboard. The movement was sluggish and heavy, Without thrusters, the gunship was simply a mass of metal falling gracefully through a low-G environment. "How are you planning to land this thing without thrusters?" said Sharokin.
"Once we're in the canyon, I'll risk some low-level bursts," said Wayland. "Enough to set us down in one piece, though it will still be an interesting landing."
Sharokin had experienced enough hostile landings under fire evacs and burning intercepts Wayland had defined simply as interesting to know that this would be only fractionally better than going down in flames. "I'll brace for impact, then," he said, turning to head back to the troop compartment.
"That might be wise," agreed Wayland.
Before Sharokin moved, a furious wail erupted from the Vox. The sine wave he'd seen earlier on the emission slate suddenly burst into life. Then it had been jumpy, its strength varying wildly. But now it was a constant blare of energy coming straight at them. "Something knows we're here," he said. Wayland didn't respond, but drove the control column forward, pushing them into a steep, almost vertical dive. Sharokin gripped the sides of his pilot's compartment, hating the lack of control he always felt when his fate was in the hands of others.
"What is it?" said Sharokin.
"Hunters,"
replied Wayland.
"From where?"
"I don't know yet. Let me process."
"Process faster," said Sharokin, watching the ground rushing up to meet them. He hoped Wayland had a better idea of their altitude. The jumping sine wave flattened, becoming a single shrieking howl that surely meant that whatever Auspex was hunting them had now found them.
"It's trying to fix our position," said Wayland.
"What is? The Chthonian Scion?"
"I don't think so. I don't recognize the frequency type."
The ground rolled, silver and black inverted as the ground became the sky. Sharokin caught a glimpse of something to their port rear quarter, as Wayland jinked the gunship in a plunging dive. Too fast to see clearly, a thing of brass and silver, spider-like and with too many hooked limbs. A machine of some sort, a predator drone or hybrid fighter craft, perhaps. Wayland pushed power to the engines, thoughts of stealth forgotten as the ground closed in. Sharokin lost sight of their pursuer as the force of Wayland's dive threw him against the fuselage. He felt the punch of high G in his gut, and his vision grayed for an instant. The Storm Eagle shuddered, and the sound of groaning metal ran its length. The Iron Hands had maintained the gunship over the years as best they could, but with the limited resources available to them, the repairs of battle damage had been ad hoc at best. Welded seams split with the violence of the manoeuvre, sparks spilled from a ruptured conduit, and warning bells echoed from the troop compartment behind them. Sharokin felt the juddering tear of something coming loose from the hull. The darkness of the shallow canyon enfolded them, the shadows stark and inviting. Wayland jinked the Storm Eagle to the side, ramming power back into the engines as the signal strength from the hunter-killer machine shrieked. The altimeter spun crazily as Wayland pushed them closer to the dirt. Jagged outcroppings and tank-sized boulders flashed past the canopy, insanely close. Suddenly, Sharokin knew exactly how close to the ground they were. The avionics panel sputtered, and a crackling voice spat from the Vox.
"Come to heading 037,
it said, croaking as if formed by a throat parched from a lifetime in the desert.
"Then cut your thrust and drop 10 meters on my mark if you want to live."
"What the—" began Sharokin. Wayland didn't argue, but simply nudged the control column as instructed. The Storm Eagle banked sharply into a branch canyon, much narrower than before, and Sharokin wanted to squeeze himself smaller. No warrior of the Raven Guard was claustrophobic, but this was threading the eye of a needle with a 70-ton aircraft at high speed. The sine wave bottomed out, a low, flat line of a constant signal. "It's locked on," said Sharokin. Wayland grunted as he fought to manoeuvre, but the canyon walls were too narrow, the ground too close.
"I have nowhere to go,"
he said. Sharokin peered through the canopy, eyes narrowing as he picked out something ahead. Something that shouldn't be there. A lone figure, standing on a raised bluff of rock, wreathed in shadows so deep even he couldn't pick out any details beyond a chromium helmet that gleamed silver like a crescent moon. Something long and slender snapped into position at its shoulder.
"Now!"
scratched the voice.
"Drop!"
Again, Wayland didn't argue, nudging the stick forward and cutting the engines. No sooner had the prow dipped than the device at the figure's shoulder bloomed with pale smoke and cherry-red fire. Sharokin ducked involuntarily as a dart-shaped missile flashed over the Storm Eagle, its blue-hot jet wash blistering the gunship's canopy as it passed within 2 meters. Shurikin expected to see a reflected flash of detonation or feel the pressure wave of an explosion, but nothing came.
"Everyone brace!"
yelled Wayland, as the Storm Eagle made an interesting landing on the lunar surface. The gunship's prow was crumpled, its spine buckled, and the fuselage split open all along its length. An outcropping of rock had gouged a tear in one wing and spun the craft around, leaving it listing like a beached whale in a pale cloud of dust. The right engine cowling leaked fumes and coolant, while the left hung by threads of cabling and a seam of blackened metal. The warriors of the Sisypheum staggered from the hole torn in the hull where the rear assault ramp used to be, their dark armor paled by hanging lunar particles. Cadmus Tyro was first from the wreckage, moving with pained steps and his bolter at the ready as he scanned the deep furrow of their descent in search of attackers. The darkness overhead was streaked with light. The explosions of dust billowed on the upper walls of the canyon as falling debris impacted. Luckily, the angle of its descent and the depth of the canyon kept the worst of it from impacting around them. Ignatius Newman followed an instant later, his Volkite cannon held out before him, the barrel crackling with barely contained energies. Freighter Thematica and Atesh Tarsa flanked him, and Ulrak Branthan came next, bending back part of the torn metal to emerge into the hostile lunar atmosphere. Garuda perched on his shoulder, its head jerking from side to side as though irritated at having been woken.
"What brought us down?" asked Branthan.
"I don't know," said Tyro. "Wayland's warning came only a second before we hit."
Branthan looked to the horizon.
"We need to move. The crash will draw the enemy's eye."
Tyro nodded and turned to issue orders to his fellow warriors.
"Freighter, head to the top of the dune ridge. Keep watch on our surroundings. Passive auspex only. Newman, gather up the ammunition still in the gunship. Tarsa, go forward and check on Shurikin and Wayland."
The salamander nodded and headed around to the buried prow of the gunship. Newman didn't move, his gaze fixed on the tops of the canyon walls.
"Newman, do as he says," said Branthan.
The veteran nodded curtly and lumbered back inside the gunship. Anger touched Tyro at Newman's flagrant deferment to Branthan, but now wasn't the time for a contest of wills between captains. Tyro's eyes narrowed as he saw a pattern of frost crawling across Branthan's grey skin. Exposed to the full force of the sun's radiation, a lunar day could reach temperatures of up to 200 degrees. At night, or in the shadow of a canyon, as they were now, it was registering at 195 degrees below zero. Insulated and reflective suits had kept the earliest lunar pioneers safe, but Ulrak Branthan's flesh was exposed to the lethal cold.
"How are you enduring this temperature?" asked Tyro. "The flesh should be freezing solid on your bones."
Branthan shrugged, the movement unnatural.
"Ulrak,"
pressed Tyro,
"answer me."
At first he thought Branthan was going to ignore him, but then the captain spoke in a voice that was unlike his normal default aggressive tone. If anything, Branthan sounded vulnerable, a trait never normally associated with a captain of the Iron Hands.
"Atesh Tarsa told me the Heart of Iron had changed me," said Branthan. "My physiology, the functioning of my organs."
"Should I be concerned?"
"About what?"
"About what else it might have changed," said Tyro.
"What are you suggesting?"
snapped Branthan, any sense of vulnerability evaporating in the face of Tyro's words.
"Since leaving stasis, your mental state could be described as erratic."
"Are you questioning my loyalty, Cadmus?"
"No, never that," said Tyro. "But none of us knows the true nature of the Heart of Iron. We don't know who made it or what changes its creators intended for it to work. That should concern us both."
"Dedicate your efforts to killing traitors, and you will have no concerns, Captain Tyro."
Thematica's voice hissed over the vox.
"Movement," said the Iron Father. "At one figure, coming in low along the furrow of our landing."
"Can you identify?"
"Not yet."
"You have it covered?"
"Of course."
The lunar dust hung thick in the low gravity, masking movement. Tyro squinted, his auto-senses crackling with static as they tried to sort true images from ghost images. A figure stepped into view. Its hunched shoulders were draped in a voluminous russet cloak, ragged, like a burned wing, and a long-barreled weapon of weathered bronze was mounted at its shoulder, rotated back on its mount to the safe position. The figure wore a gleaming silver helmet, and a wire-wound staff of cables and jangling charms held in its left hand looked like something a tribal shaman might carry. Its body was insulated within a series of heavy thermal bandages, looped around its body and upper limbs, two at each shoulder, two at the waist, in a repeating angular pattern, like an ancient mummified queen of Gyptus. Queen, because what body plan was visible of the figure, was unmistakably female.
"Is that a Genevich?" said Tyro, pulling his bolter in tight to his shoulder.
"I don't know,"
answered Branthon.
"I've never seen one before."
The arm that had once belonged to Brother Bombastus came up, and the flex steel ammo belt of the storm bolter clattered as it fed oversized shells into the weapon. One of the figure's hands clutched a disturbingly organic collection of biomechanical tentacle-like limbs, which were in turn attached to the body of a rigid and segmented thing she was dragging behind her, like a hunter returning with a prize kill. To Tyro, it looked like the bastard offspring of a spider and a squid. Garuda pushed off Branthon's shoulder, its beak opening and closing, screeching in silent hostility.
"That's far enough," said Branthon.
The figure looked up, as though only now aware of their presence.
"Identify yourself."
A grating wheeze, like rusty spars of metal being dragged across an iron deck, issued from beneath the figure's helmet.
"You come to my world and demand to know who I am."
She kept coming, hauling the machine carcass behind her.
"This demersal splicer almost latched onto your craft," she said. "Lucky for you, I still had a low-yield E-mag, eh? It's one of our uglier creations, this. Would have slaved your avionic system to its control and flown you into a cliff. That'd be a wreck you wouldn't be walking out of, I can tell you."
Crackling traceries of violet light flickered across the segmented surfaces of the splicer.
Haywire, thought Tyro.
The downed machine wasn't dead, just paralyzed. Thematica moved parallel to her, his aim never wavering from the beacon of her silver skull. If she so much as twitched in a hostile manner, the Iron Father would put a mass reactive through her brain.
"Identify yourself,"
ordered Branthon again, as the figure kept coming. The Gene Witch lifted her staff, and every weapon snapped to her.
"Kill me, and I'll make this machine scream loud enough the sons of Horus will hear it with their own flesh ears," she said.
"Who are you?"
demanded Tyro.
"I know who it is,"
said Sabic Wayland, coming around the flanks of the downed gunship. Nykona Sharukin and Atesh Tarsa had to hold him upright, as the lower portion of the Iron Father's right leg was missing below the middle of his thigh. Tattered shreds of meat and metal hung from the crude seal of a synth skin dressing.
"Bad landing," said the Gene Witch.
"I've had better," agreed Wayland. "But I can get it to fly again."
"Doubt it,"
said the figure.
"Came down hard."
"No thanks to you."
"What's going on, Wayland?"
said Branthon, without taking his aim from the silver-helmed figure.
"Who is that?"
"Put your guns away," said Wayland. "That is Talab Vita 37, and she just saved our lives."
Chapter 6. The Paths Below. Not Meant to Be. Change of Plans. The Gene Witch tilted her head back to scan the light-streaked sky.
"What are you looking for?"
asked Tyro.
"Your fleet," said Talab Vita 37. "Squadrons of attack ships in formation. A lone warship with city-leveling ordnance. Something that tells me you heard my message and took it seriously."
"We heard it,"
said Tyro. "But the only things like that in orbit are traitor ships."
"So it's just you?"
"It's just us."
"Then how do you intend to destroy Herodotus Omega? My message was specific, yes? Wipe it clean of life?"
"We are space marines," said Branthon. "We can destroy anything, and we do not need starships to do it.
So sure of yourself, said Talab Vita
37.
That always was your kind's flaw. Those who embrace certainty and reject doubt are the ones we should have feared. We should have seen it back then. Should have seen it and refused to comply. That's the truth of it.
Talab Vita 37 shrugged and spun her staff around, then sheathed it over her shoulder. She dropped the coiled tentacle cables of the demersal splicer and said,
Never liked these bioconstructs. Vicious things with delusions of grandeur and a sadistic streak. Didn't do a damn thing but slow Lupercal's curves by a minute or less anyway.
The Gene Witch unsettled Tyro in a way he could not articulate, and it took a measure of self-restraint he hadn't known he possessed to let her approach unharmed. He tried to rationalize it as just his war posture in the face of an unknown entity, but part of him knew there was more to it than that. The Gene Witches were an ancient, potent force, and rumors of their existence went back to a time when the secret knowledge they had possessed was thought to be magic.
You are Talab Vita 37?
Asked Branthon. She stopped and looked at him curiously.
I am Talab Vita 37, daughter of the moon, child of Luna. Who are you?
Bolrak Branthon, captain of the 10th Legion.
Talab Vita 37 looked him up and down.
And what are you? Something worse than even we made. And we made nightmares.
She didn't wait for an answer and turned to Tyro.
And you? Who are you?
Cadmus Tyro.
Iron Hands, said Talab Vita 37,
turning to scan the rest of the warriors and seeing Atesh Tarsa and Nykona Sharukin.
But not all of you.
Not all of us, agreed Tyro. The infamy at Istvan V brought brothers of many legions together, and the fighting since then has forged our brotherhood in iron.
Talab Vita 37 nodded and reached up to snap a frozen droplet of blood from his armor. She held it to the reflective surface of her helmet, and Tyro's visor detected radiant heat emanating from its surface. As the blood began to melt, she smeared it over where her mouth would have been, if she'd had any features to discern. Cursive forms of light played under the helmet's surface, crescents and loops of helical spirals.
10th Legion, 3rd generation, Medusan-born,
said Talab Vita 37.
Blood type AXR positive theta. Part of the Omnia Schiaparelli stratum. High concentrations of the Stalix genotype. A modification of the Gajana generation pairings. Too high, really. Can lead to a predisposition for pain-induced psychotrauma. But I expect you already know that.
What are you talking about? What does any of that mean?
It means we bred you all to be resilient,
said Talab Vita 37.
But you exhibit levels I haven't seen in a long time. Put a bolt through your skull, and I think you might still get up, eh?
We are the Iron Tenth, said Branthon. We endure pain. It is what we do.
There's truth in that,
agreed Talab Vita 37.
But your Legion's gene code is concentrated beyond what we advised. Your sire always did like to push things farther than he ought.
Our sire? You mean Ferus Manus?
Said Branthon.
No,
said Talab Vita 37, turning to face the Iron Father.
Your other sire. The one who sent his wolves to first yoke us to his terrible ambition.
Tyro's anger simmered just below the surface, and he saw it mirrored in the tension of his battle brothers.
To speak such words while the throne world is besieged is a sure and certain way to find death, said Branthon.
Talab Vita 37 regarded him quizzically and shook her head.
So fragile,
she said with a throaty wheeze that might have been a chuckle.
Another side effect of hyper-aggressive masculine traits. Time is against us, and you still look to find fault in warm air passing over my lips.
Tyro felt Branthon's fury ratchet up a notch and fought to quell his own. After all, she was right. Time was the enemy now.
The Magna Mater, where is it?
Talab Vita 37 shook her head, somehow managing to look contrite and dejected without so much as a single facial feature.
I bore its burden for so long, alone and hidden from my sisters. I could not take my ease with them or find succor at any of the wellsprings. For Heliosa 54 made sure every scrap of me was erased, for fear I would be revealed and taken. My sisters forgot me. The moon herself forgot me. But I kept it safe, bound to Luna, but passing unseen in the cracks of existence and perception.
She sank to her knees, and Tyro saw the immense depths of sadness within her.
I kept it with me for 2 centuries and more, she continued, until my flesh and mind could bear the toll of solitude no longer. Heliosa 54 had tasked me, you see, tasked me with keeping it safe, close, but far from those who would misuse it. I could not do that if my body failed. I needed to rest, to regenerate in the healing light of the wellsprings. But I could not take